Well, as was mentioned in the sermonette, today's the 20th anniversary of 9/11, on those 9/11 attacks on this country. You know, all I have to say is 9/11. And if you're, 20 years of age or older, we all know what I'm talking about, don't we? You know, I'm not meaning to dial 911. 9/11 is seared into our minds as those attacks. It was one of those days where we all remember exactly where we were, exactly what we were doing at that point in time. For example, where I worked at the time, we had a gymnasium, a little gymnasium that was built into there, and it was right next to my office. And in that gym, there was a TV. You know, once you got word that something had happened, there were a bunch of us. We spent the entire morning standing there, eyes glued to the TV. We watched as that second plane hit live. And we watched in horror as one building fell. And then the second building fell. And then you heard the reports of the plane that hit the Pentagon. And then you heard the reports that came in of the other that crashed into a field in Pennsylvania. The world changed that day. And not for the better. We're now 20 years on from that, aren't we? And our nation is more deeply divided and full of anger than in any time I know since I've been alive. We just pulled out of Afghanistan. We handed it back to the very same evil forces that we took it from 20 years ago after the 9/11 attacks. And even though it's not spoken out loud, there is that very real sense that evil will be back. It's simply a matter of time. Scary stuff. You know, we're coming up on a holy day that pictures the putting away of Satan the devil. And we know that he's the God of this world. We know that he is that great deceiver. He is the father of lies. But he's ultimately responsible for all of the evil that's in this world. Instead of reviewing any certain aspect of atonement today, what I'd like to do, I'd like to take a step back, if you will, kind of look at it perhaps at the 20,000-foot level and ask this question: why is there evil in the world? Why is there evil in the world? It's a rhetorical question. I don't expect you to give me an actual answer. And when you think about this, why is there evil in the world? It's one of those questions where your first inclination when you hear that is to jump up and say, well, it's because of... And then you have to stop and you have to pause. You have to think about it. There is no doubt. Evil is definitely there. But, you know, in order to give a comprehensive answer as to why there's evil in the world, we have to stop and admit to ourselves it gets complicated as to the reasons why. We all know, we all acknowledge there is evil in the world, but how did it get there? Now, if we look at this from the point of view of an atheist or perhaps an evolutionist or anybody, for that matter, that does not believe in a God or a creator of any sort, how would they explain evil? Think about that for a minute. See, if the universe is simply this result of random interactions of all these atoms and these molecules and proteins all colliding together, if it just came about randomly, then this idea of evil, or for that matter, the idea of good, is meaningless. Because everything is random. And because of that, then good and evil are simply constructs that are placed upon certain interactions. Perhaps you've heard of the song, Que Sera, Sera. You know, if you're a certain age, and when I say that, you've got that melody now running through your head. It was actually done in the 1950s by Doris Day, and it was film music is what it was, but it was very popular. The phrase, Que Sera, Sera, is often interpreted to mean, whatever will be, will be. This phrase, que sera, sera, carries this connotation of leaving one's life in the hands of fate. Today we might say, it is what it is. Same sort of thing. Whatever happens, happens. You know, there are many despots down throughout history that have used that very concept, that very philosophy, to perpetuate some pretty bad stuff. They've used it for their lust of power. I'm going to take what's mine, to the detriments of millions upon millions of innocent people. Others, on the other hand, will try to explain evil as a judgment in our human minds regarding things or events that happen as part of our fight for survival as individuals or as a society or even as part of the evolutionary process. Survival of the fittest. We've been told that. So we murder, we lie, we steal. We do it all to get ahead of the other guy. To survive. We want to be that one that's considered the fittest. So we do what we have to do in order to get ahead. To be that one that is the fittest. We commit adultery. To spread or to perpetuate our DNA. Survival of the fittest again. Greed is good. Hitler, for example, used that line of reasoning. If you remember, he had his master race. They were to be genetically superior. And therefore, he felt that others were inferior. Millions of people died because of that. Like the Jews, the gypsies, those with disabilities were considered inferior. Survival of the fittest. See, it was that thinking that actually created an entire world war. The entire planet was involved in a war because of that thinking. When you look at it, though, most sane human beings do not think that way. They don't think I can do whatever I want because it's survival of the fittest or that it's purely random. Most people believe in a god or gods. You know, whether it's an actual deity, whether it's some form of nature, but they believe in good and evil as concepts given to mankind by a superior authority. But what about people who believe in God? What about people who believe in the true God? And there are critics out there that might, and they do say this, they say, you know, okay, you believe there's a God. You believe he's the creator and sustainer of all things. And we would have to say, yes, we agree with that. And then they would come back with this. Therefore, it would mean that this, first of all, God created evil. And the thought goes like this. If God created all things, that would mean that he had evil within himself. And therefore, by extension, he is the source of evil. The other thing that they will say is that God sustains evil. You know, if he's all powerful, he can start, he can stop anything he wants. And therefore, because he allows evil to exist, to continue, to persist, he's ultimately responsible for it still being here. Now, we know that these two propositions are not true. But they are logical questions, aren't they? They deserve an answer. And we're supposed to be able to defend our beliefs. And so this is probably something we should know how to properly answer. Did God create evil? I want to take all the fun of it. I want to get right up front here and tell you, God did not create evil. Let's start there with our starting point. He didn't create murder, lying, stealing. He didn't create war. But what he did do is he created the opportunity for evil. He created the opportunity for evil. And you have to look at that and say, why would he do that? Why would he do that? And that's because each and every one of us was created with what we call free moral agency. And we hear that term quite often, this free moral agency. And you look it up, it's actually a theological phrase. It's something fancy that the theologians put out there. And it means we are free to live and think and act according to our own will. free moral agency. Today we might call it free will. Every human being that has ever lived was created with their minds capable of thinking their own thoughts, capable of making their own decisions. And before God created mankind, He created other spiritual beings. And as human beings, we are, when you look at it, we're spirit beings in process. That's our potential, that's our future, but we're not there yet. We are not spirit yet. We're still physical, flesh and blood. But we're on a journey, aren't we? And ideally, the end result is that we would result in spirit beings. But when God created the original spirit beings, they were also created with minds. They were also created with this free moral agency. So they could think thoughts. They could reason logically. And you look at some of the descriptions, He made these angels beautiful. He made them with amazing gifts and talents. And we're never told when they were created. But we know, for example, they were around when God created the earth. We're told at the beginning they sang for joy at the creation of the earth. They have feelings. They respond to different things. And He gave them all tasks to perform to prepare the earth for something else, something very special, something that was yet to come as part of His creation plan, His ultimate plan. Let's start today in Hebrews, book of Hebrews, Hebrews 1 and verse 14. See something here about these angels, this angelic realm, if you will. Hebrews 1 and verse 14. And in verse 13, it identifies who we're talking about here is the angels. And so in verse 14, it says, "Are they, or the angels, not all ministering spirits? Sent forth to minister for those who will inherit salvation." Okay, so they're spirit beings, but they were made different than mankind. They were made for a different purpose. Now, you can read through the Bible, we're never told that they were created in the image of God. Mankind, we're specifically told, was created in the image of God, like God was. So these angels, they were created for different purposes. We look here that this word minister has the application of a public servant, one who carries out the commands of others, a deacon, if you will. You look at some of them, it's the same sort of office, one of service, something that can be applied to the office of a deacon. But there's a difference here. Notice it talks about those that are the heirs of salvation, those who will inherit salvation. Those are the ones that will become part of the family of God. But these angels, they're those ministering spirits. They're those who were specifically created to serve. Again, but when we look at it, they were not created as robots. They're not mindless. They have emotions. They have feelings. They have the ability to decide for themselves. In other words, free will. And at some point in history, in ancient history, what we see is a portion of these beings, these spirit beings, decided they didn't agree with what God had planned. And we're never given the reason why. You know, what was it that caused them to disagree with God and His plan? Perhaps, and this is a logical thought, it was the idea that He was planning to create other beings who would eventually become spirit beings, which was mankind, and that those beings would, when completed, when matured, would be superior to them. Perhaps that was the thought. And if you've ever had, someone promoted over you at work, somebody who was possibly a subordinate and is now suddenly your boss, you know it. It's easy to get your feelings hurt. It's easy to feel as if you're not valued as an employee, as a part of that company. Could it be that the angels felt that way? We don't know, but whatever the reason was, at some point you had a portion of these angels that began to question what God was doing. They got to a point where they decided for themselves. They were using their free will. They somehow got to this point where they felt things would go better if they were in charge instead of God. And we'll see a little bit later, but a full third of these spirit beings, these angels, rebelled against God. Let's go to Isaiah. Isaiah 14. Isaiah 14, verses 13 and 14. We can start in verse 12. This is talking about Lucifer. Heading in my Bible says the fall of Lucifer. Here's what God says in verse 12. How you have fallen from heaven, O Lucifer, son of the morning. How you were cut down to the ground, you who weakened the nations. For you have said in your heart, notice all the I's here, right? I will ascend into heaven. I will exalt my throne above the stars of God. I will also sit on the mount of the congregation on the farthest sides of the north. I will ascend above the heights and the clouds. I will be like the Most High. I. Evil begins with this exercise of free will against God. This exercise of free will against His commands, His authority, His way of life. So did God create evil? No, He didn't. But He created the opportunity for evil through free will, through this ability that you have, that I have, to choose for ourselves what is right and what is wrong. He created that opportunity in the angels. He created that opportunity in you. He created it in me. And the proper exercise of free will is essential to becoming like God our Father. So we have to know how to use it, and to use it properly. And you read on with the story of Satan, we understand he leads this charge into heaven, and the rebellion failed. You think about it, it had to. God is all powerful. He is far above any other rule or authority or power or dominion. The rebellion never had any chance of succeeding. And this shows us the example that any being with free will has the capacity to do something really stupid. Satan had to know. He had no chance of success. And yet, he convinced himself to do it anyway. Have you ever done anything that you knew wasn't going to work, but you did it anyway? And you knew that. You look back on it and you said, boy, that was dumb. But you did it anyway. So how do we know? That was the next question. How do we know that Satan's rebellion failed? We know because Christ Himself told us that. Let's notice that in Luke. Luke 10, verse 17. Start in verse 17 here, Luke 10. Kind of setting it up here. Back in verse 1, we see where Christ had appointed 70 people, and He sent them out two by two to all these different cities to spread the gospel message, to heal the sick, things like that. Notice here in verse 17, they're coming back. In verse 17, the 70 returned with joy, saying, Lord, even the demons are subject to us in your name. So he had appointed these 70. They went out two by two. And they report back here these amazing things. And one of the things that they report is, wow, even the demons are subject to us. Now, I don't know if you've ever been involved in a situation where there was also a demon involved. But take it from me, it's not a situation you take lightly. You see, you have this realization, there's something out there that's beyond us. It's a little unnerving, trust me. So they had had that experience, and they came away, said even the demons respect them. These guys weren't ordained, nothing like that. They'd just been sent out by Christ. And so they're amazed. Even the demons, it says, listen to them. So why was that? It was because these men were sent out by Jesus Christ, who was a member of the God family, and God has dominion over the angelic realm. The entire angelic realm. And so Christ gave that authority to these men. And so what you see is these demons, they had no choice. They had no option to disagree, to go against what God says. Now you look at it, in the demonic world, they actually do have quite a bit of latitude. But at the same time, there is a line. And they know they cannot cross that line. Notice verse 18. And he, or Christ, said to them, I saw Satan fall like lightning from heaven. So imagine these guys come back, they're all excited, even the demons pay attention to us. And what does Christ answer back with? You know, if they felt they were going to be praised, or if they felt that they were going to be given some long explanation for the demons being subject to them, they were wrong. One sentence. Christ says basically, I know, because I was there when Satan crashed and burned. And we see over and over again where Jesus Christ himself cast out demons. You see that in the New Testament. He told them to leave. And even though there were some cases where they would talk back to him, they realized his authority. Because when he told them to leave, they left. Why? Because he was of the God family. He had dominion over them. They had to do his bidding. It wasn't like, you know, he was in some contest with them. He's not in a contest with anybody in the demonic realm. They were never in any way equals. These demons had to do his bidding. Now he goes on even beyond that. Let's continue on in verse 19 and 20. He issues a warning here. Behold, I give you authority. So this is where they got the authority. To trample on serpents and scorpions and over all the power of the enemy. Nothing shall by any means hurt you. Nevertheless, do not rejoice in this that the spirits are subject to you, but rather rejoice because your names are written in heaven. In other words, he's saying, yes, I gave you the authority, the power to deal with demons. But don't allow that to cloud your judgment. Don't let it go to your head. Don't allow it to begin to make wrong choices. Instead, he says, rejoice that you're on the right team. Let's go now to Revelation. Revelation 12, verse 3 and 4. Revelation 12, verse 3 and 4. And it says, another sign appeared in heaven. Behold, a great fiery red dragon, having seven heads, 10 horns, 7 diadems on his head, and his tail drew a third of the stars of heaven, threw them to the earth. And the dragon stood before the woman who was ready to give birth, to devour her child as soon as it was born. This tells us a couple of things here. First, it indicates a number for us. It says a third of the angels followed Satan. We don't know how many that is. We're never told how many angels there are. But it is significant to realize the scope of the rebellion. 1 in 3 followed Satan. It also gives us a clue why, when you read through the early New Testament church, there appeared to be so much demonic activity at the time of Jesus Christ. Have you ever noticed that? They were constantly dealing with demons, and it was like second nature to them. I've often wondered about that. During the life of Jesus Christ, you read over and over again of him casting out demons or of his disciples casting out demons. There was a lot of demonic activity. And if you look at it, it seemed to be centered in that area around them. And you take a step back and you think about it, it would make sense. Think of it from Satan's point of view. Satan, if you look at it, he's considering this a weakness in the plan of God. Because you have Jesus Christ, a very member of the Godhead, all-powerful, he's going to empty himself. He's going to make himself human. In other words, weak. You know, and at that point, Satan's thinking to himself, if I can only get to him in his weakened state, he knew he could thwart God's plan. He could derail the entire plan. He sees it as a choke point, if you will. From what we read here in Revelation 12, Satan and his demons were there when Christ was born in order to destroy him, to prevent him from living and then dying for all of mankind. They were all focused. They were singularly focused on this weak link that they thought they saw in God's plan. Let's go to verses 7 through 9 now. It says, "War broke out in heaven. Michael and his angels fought with the dragon. And the dragon and his angels fought, but they did not prevail, nor was a place found for them in heaven any longer. So that great dragon was cast out, that serpent of old, called the devil and Satan, who deceives the whole world. And he was cast to the earth, and his angels were cast out with him." Drop down to verse 12 and 13. It says, "Therefore rejoice, O heavens, and you who dwell in them. Woe to the inhabitants of the earth and to the sea, for the devil has come down to you having great wrath, because he knows that he has a short time. And now when the dragon saw that he had been cast to the earth, he persecuted the woman who gave birth to the male child." And we come to understand that Satan is once again going to attempt to overthrow God in heaven. And as we see here again, he's going to be defeated. And he and his demons are going to be thrown down to the earth. Only this time, notice here, we see an urgency. We see a renewed nastiness in all of his actions. He's especially angry. The entire earth is going to feel the impact of that anger, of that evil. But we see something here. He is specifically coming after the church. And you read through all of these things, and you have to ask yourself, why didn't God get rid of Satan permanently a long time ago? And we read through God's plan, and we see, and especially mentioned with this holy day that's coming up, we read where God's going to eventually place Satan and his demons in a place of restraint. Why didn't he do that a long time ago? Couldn't he have ended a whole lot of pain and suffering? Instead, Satan and his demons were hurled out of heaven to the earth. And you look at it, it looks like God just moved them. He got tired of messing with them. You guys step to the side. You guys go over here. So did he do that so he wouldn't have to deal with them? And again, though, because God allowed Satan to be here on this earth, and because Satan is evil, couldn't you say that God is indirectly responsible for the presence of evil in our world? After all, he allowed it. God could have gotten rid of Satan, but he didn't. God could stop Satan today, but he doesn't. Why is that? In the first chapters of Genesis, we read where Adam and Eve were created. They were placed in the Garden of Eden. And we're never told how long it was, but it didn't take much time, you have to figure, before Satan showed up on the scene. Who allowed Satan into the Garden of Eden? You know, an all-powerful and all-knowing God surely would have known that Satan was there. I missed the snake. I wasn't looking for the snake. See, Satan wasn't fooling God. He knew Satan was there. So God allowed it. So who allowed Satan into our way of thinking? We did. That began with Adam and Eve. They could have rejected him. Right there in the garden. As soon as he said something, they could have said, I'm sorry, I'm not supposed to be talking to you. You know, bugger off. Get out of here. Think about how different the story would have been if they had done that. But they didn't. See, they exercised their free will choice. They had a choice to make. And they made a choice. The choice was, hey, I want to learn about this good and evil. And so they accept the good. And along with it, they accept the evil, the bad. And unfortunately, when they did that, as we know, it opened up Pandora's box. And we're left with the remnants of their decision. But every human being since then has made that same choice. That choice to accept Satan's thinking into their lives. They've made that conscious choice. So from the very beginning, from the Garden of Eden, God had a purpose here on this earth. That was to create sons and daughters within the family of God. Beginning with Adam and Eve. See, those that would become children of God would be like Him. Like Him in mind and spirit and character. But there are a couple of traits that are also very similar. Traits that we must also have if we are to become part of the God kind. These two traits, the first one is everlasting life. That's what's going to happen. We will have everlasting life. We will be spirit. We will be immortal. We will no longer be restrained by our physical bodies. The second trait that we will have as part of the God family, the God kind, is one that we already have, and that's free moral agency. That free will, that freedom of choice. We'll still have that. And when you look at it, though, you put these two elements together, somebody with free moral agency and the ability to live forever. Think about it. There's potential there. Even if it's slight, there is that potential that's there, isn't there, for some serious trouble. God already experienced that with Satan and the demons. But see, this is going to be different. Because Satan and the demons are of the angelic realm. They were never going to be on the God plane of existence. But we are. We have that potential to become part of the very family of God. That's a level that the angels will never be able to attain. I don't know about you, but when I think about this, when I consider it, in my limited way of thinking, my very human way of thinking, I consider God's taking a huge risk. He's wanting to add billions of spirit beings to His family, and none of them are going to be rebellious? I consider myself fairly conservative in my actions and my thinking, and when I look at that proposition, and just knowing the few people that I do, comparatively, I would have to say God's taking a very big risk. Fortunately, I'm not God. He knows. He knows exactly what He's doing. So before God gives us everlasting life, He needs to know our hearts and minds. What will we do with eternal life? Is it possible we would end up just like Lucifer did? would we choose to become the enemy, the adversary of God? You know, God, I was right there with you, right up to that point in time where you told the church that I had to wear a mask to church, and then, I don't know. You really rubbed me the wrong way. God can't ever expect that from us. So that is why, from the very beginning, God exposed humans to evil, to Satan, to his fallen demons, to the evil that they promote. See, we all must get to the point where we choose one way or the other. And there's great suffering. We live with the consequences of the choices that we make. And it's that way for all of us. No one is exempt from this. You think of it, you know, you take a rock and you throw it out into the pond and it makes the ripples. And every one of us, you know, we're that little ripple, and then you have multiples and all these ripples come together. We live on a planet. 7.8 billion of our friends and neighbors are out there. And we're all making choices. And we're all having to live with the consequences. And one person's choice begins to interact with another person's choice, and the result gets magnified and it gets muddied. And the world is awash in the ebb and the flow of all of these choices that are being made. Consider that even if we ourselves make really good choices, there's still plenty of people around us who don't. This is not one of these exercises where the good and the evil have to balance out. And if they balance out, then we're all good. It's not like that at all. Any evil causes suffering, causes grief, causes pain. Now, with the knowledge, with the help of God, we can make good choices along the way. And when we do that, God will protect us. He will guide us along the way. But that doesn't mean we get to live our lives without pain and suffering. Now, God also exposes those to whom he loves, to Satan, to the evil one, for the purpose of testing, perfecting the character in their lives by allowing them to suffer. And it's not that God enjoys inflicting pain. He doesn't. But he's measuring the choices that we make. How do we choose to manage our free will? He has to know that we're not going to get upset, that we're going to get bent out of shape, that we're going to turn on him. And he's right there through these different processes with us. But he has to know. 1 Thessalonians 2 and verse 4. 1 Thessalonians 2 and verse 4. And this is a sentence, kind of breaking into the thought here from Paul. But he's talking about the ministry. In verse 4 it says, "But as we have been approved by God to be entrusted with the gospel, even so we speak, not as pleasing men, but God." Now this is the part I want to look at, the last phrase, "God who tests our hearts." We see a quality of God here that's inserted at the very end of this sentence. God is testing, it says, our hearts. Mounce's concise Greek to English dictionary says of this word test, says to approve after trial, to judge worthy, to decide upon after examination. So what is God doing? He's examining. And again, to approve after trial. You have to be worthy. Let's go back to the Old Testament. Deuteronomy 8. Deuteronomy 8, verses 2 and 3. Deuteronomy 8, and starting at verse 2. It says, "You shall remember that the Lord your God led you all these 40 years in the wilderness to humble you and test you, to know what was in your heart, whether you would keep his commandments or not." Verse 3. "So he humbled you, allowed you to hunger, fed you with manna, which you did not know, nor did your fathers know, that he might make you know that man shall not live by bread alone, but man lives by every word that proceeds from the mouth of God." We're talking about the very same thing, aren't we, in the Old Testament that Paul was talking about in his letter to the Thessalonians. God who judges the heart. We see the same thing. God led the children of Israel into a place where there was no food and water. He did it, says, to test them. He said he would take care of them, and he did. He fed them with the manna, provided water for them for 40 years. When we see here that this word humbled, the word humbled here means to afflict, to become low, to be bowed down. It's the very same attitude that we're to have for atonement. To be afflicted, to become low, to be bowed down. So the reason that he humbled the children of Israel was so that they would learn that there was more to life than food. That we should instead be focused more on what God says. And you look at it, that's the very same message that Jesus Christ gave in Matthew 6. Makes sense. You know, Jesus Christ was that same God of the Old Testament. In Matthew 6, he said, don't worry about what you're going to eat or what you're going to drink or what you're going to wear. And instead he said, seek first the kingdom of God. That should be a lesson that we have front and center in our minds that we should be learning from the Day of Atonement. You know, you're hungry is our focus on God. Conditions continue to deteriorate in this world. There's a greater hatred. There's a greater division. There's more evil than ever before. And it's easy for us to get distracted by this storm that seems to be raging out of control all around us. It's easy to focus on the fact that we're in pain. We're hungry, if you will. So we have to ask, where is our focus? As bad as evil may be, we can take some limited comfort in knowing that Satan can only do what he's allowed to do. Again, there's that line he cannot cross. Think of it this way. He's under a restraining order from God. We ought to be really thankful for that. But he still has a long rope. Let's notice a couple of those examples. Job, the book of Job, Job 1. I want to read verses 6 through 12. You know, and the view that we're given here, the interaction that we see, how often we just read right over this. But, I mean, have you ever stopped and thought about and meditate what's going on here? I mean, I can't even begin to picture in my mind what that was like. But it's stated out here, starting in verse 6, Job 1 and verse 6. "Now there was a day when the sons of God came to present themselves before the Lord, and Satan also came among them. And the Lord said to Satan, 'From where do you come?' So Satan answered the Lord, and he said, 'From going to and fro on the earth, from walking back and forth on it.' Then the Lord said to Satan, 'Have you considered my servant Job? There is none like him on the earth, a blameless and upright man, one who fears God and shuns evil.' So Satan answered the Lord, and he said, 'Does Job fear God for nothing? You have made a hedge around him, around his household, around all that he has on every side. You have blessed the work of his hands, and the possessions have increased in the land. But now, stretch out your hand, touch all that he has, and he will surely curse you to your face. And the Lord said to Satan, Behold, all that he has is in your power, only do not lay a hand on him. So Satan went out from the presence of the Lord. This is a very vivid reminder, if you will. Satan can only do what God allows him to do. We see here God's protection extended not only past Job, but to his family, to his property, to all of his possessions. Satan has to obtain permission to touch anything that belonged to Job. Any of his possessions, his land, anything. There are times when God wants to test our hearts and minds. Sometimes Satan is the tool that he allows to be used. Satan is that tool that he uses. But you know, even in those cases, there are very careful guidelines. We see that. Let's go to the New Testament now. Luke 22. Luke 22, verses 31 and 32. Luke 22, verse 31 and 32. And the Lord said, Simon, Simon. So he's talking to Peter. He says, Indeed, Satan has asked for you that he may sift you as wheat. But I have prayed for you that your faith should not fail. And when you have returned to me, strengthen your brethren. Now this was right before Christ was to be arrested. And there's a very similar situation we see with what we saw with Job. Notice here, Jesus does not say, you know, Satan has been sifting you, and I'm here fighting for you, Peter. Doesn't say that, does he? Well, he says, Satan has been asking, just like he did with Job. He's been asking to be able to get to you. He wanted to do with Peter what he'd been allowed to do with Job. But Satan had to ask permission to mess with Peter, to mess with any of them. Could it be that he also has to ask permission to be involved with our lives as well? Notice in here something interesting too, that in verse 32, Christ seemed to know that Peter would fail. Because notice he says, when you have returned to me. So he knew Peter would fall, Peter would get back up, Peter would come back strengthened. He knew that. See, God the Father wants all to learn that the only kind of life that really works is the life that he reveals in his word. There is no alternative way that works. And to prove that, God allows humanity to live in that alternative way. And as Paul says in Galatians 1, he calls it this present evil age. I think we could all agree with that. You know, but God, I try really hard to live my life according to the example that Jesus Christ set. I'm obedient. I trust you at your word. I have faith that you will do what you say you're going to do. So why must I suffer? See, that's often what we say, usually in the midst of when we're suffering, isn't it? Why me? You know, there's a lot that can be learned by hearing. A lot can be learned by being taught. There's a lot that can be learned by seeing the example of others, by going to YouTube. There's all kinds of neat things on there. However, there are some things that can only be learned by experience. Any who are parents are familiar with this concept. Don't touch the stove, it'll burn you. Don't touch the stove, it'll burn you. You had to touch the stove, didn't you? We've all done it. Our kids have all done it, it seems like. Something along those lines. By the fact that you believe that you trust God, It means that you're way ahead of most of the people in this world. God will provide you with the faith, the strength that you need. But we still have to live our lives in this present evil age. You know, all this has been very helpful and very interesting, but what does it have to do with the Day of Atonement? See, God has a plan, as we've been talking about, and at a certain point in time, He's going to switch gears. After 6,000 years of choosing our own way, after 6,000 years of God allowing us to be mentally, spiritually dominated by Satan, at some point in time, He's going to switch that gear. He's going to turn everything upside down. And He's going to show humanity what living 1,000 years under His rule looks like. But in order to get that ball rolling, things will have to change. God's going to install a new authority on earth who is good. We rehearsed that just the other day with the Feast of Trumpets. Jesus Christ is going to come back. He's going to replace the present evil ruler. He's going to replace Satan. We just went through that, what it pictures. Let's finally turn to Revelation 20, verses 1 through 3. Revelation 20, verses 1 through 3. Revelation 20, verse 1, I saw an angel coming down from heaven, having the key to the bottomless pit, a great chain in his hand. He laid hold of the dragon, that serpent of old, who is the devil and Satan, bound him for 1,000 years. And he cast him into a bottomless pit, and he shut him up, and he set a seal on him, so that he should deceive the nations no more till the 1,000 years were finished. But after these things he must be released for a little while. So after Christ returns to this earth, all power and all authority, in order to replace that current ruler, first of all, you have to remove him. To remove him from power before all of these positive changes can begin to be made. As we just saw here, this is not the final removal of evil. This is not the final removal where Satan is completely removed. But for 1,000 years, we're going to see a world without evil for the very first time. This is what God intended all along. This is what we picture through the Feast of Tabernacles, that joyous period of time. And then finally, all that have ever lived are going to rise again to see, to compare what they lived before with what they now have to live. And they get to choose. They have a choice to make. You know, as part of my personal correspondence duties, I'm occasionally asked to call someone who called in with an issue. Yesterday, I actually had a conversation with a lady in Florida. Now, she claimed to be a Christian, but her boyfriend of 2 years was not, she said, by any means. She says he was a nice guy, he's a great guy, but he had nothing to do whatsoever with religion. This past Monday, she went over to his apartment early in the morning, found him dead of a drug overdose. And she told me she didn't even know he did drugs. So she was devastated in that. But even more so, she was fearful that because he wasn't religious, that he was in hell and that he was going to be in torment forever. See, that fear was of anything, was even greater than her grief. And so you're talking to someone like that, and we talked about the resurrections. We talked that her boyfriend was simply sleeping. Someday he would come back to life. Someday he would be given that opportunity to learn the right way and to choose for the first time. And that's what we're going to see in the second resurrection. All these people will be given their first opportunity to make an informed choice. But they will be given that choice. Some will choose eternal life. Others will choose eternal death. That, of course, is the point of the last great day. So this Day of Atonement, you look at it, what's it all about? It's the next step in God's amazing plan. It's where sons and daughters, potential sons and daughters, they take free will. They can make informed choices. And they can choose what is right. See, God did not create evil. He created choice. Think about that. Would we want it any other way than to have free choice? To choose wisely. Choose life.